Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you another Art Monthly talk show, which goes out on Resonance FM, which is a DAB radio station, but it can be streamed online as well. And then it finally, the programme goes out a month after it's broadcast on Resonance as a podcast, which you can activate anytime you like on your podcast apps. It's on my iPhone podcast app, and I'm sure it'll be on yours wherever you are and whatever you use. Thank you for listening. Today, I am joined by Mark Prince. He has written a feature in the December-January issue of Art Monthly. That's number 482. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Matt.
Mark, how would you like to be described? I've got here artist and writer.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm a writer these days.
Yes, and you're based in Berlin, which I visited recently and love going to whenever I can.
That's right.
Now, I'm not going to read out the description of what Art Monthly wrote at the beginning of your piece, but it's called, and I'm just hurriedly rushing, Cultural Protectionism in Art Monthly, and it starts on page 11 of issue 482. But I'm going to begin by quickly reading a small quote from it. Here we go. The hypervigilance of early 21st century culture on tenderhooks to avoid the appearance of granting undue bias to any particular party parallels that of the last gasps of US modernist abstraction committed to one party's categorical hegemony. The formalism of the 1960s and the political correctness of the 2020s share a terror of putting a foot wrong, raising the question, what were they afraid of? And obviously, what we fear, or what do we fear? Mark, I chose that quote just because I wanted to try to show listeners the breadth of your piece. So you're beginning historically, you know, you're talking about formalist abstract painting at the beginning, but you're connecting it with something happening and things happening now. For instance, you end up with Cameron Rowland, an exhibition of his in MMK's Frankfurt's Tower. I mean, the question I think is probably fair to ask is, can you just try to tell me and the listeners how you're connecting these two very time-wise spread out things, but making them connect in some way?
Well, this feature came out of my reading a feature I wrote for Art Monthly nearly 20 years ago, which was called Conceptual Formalism, which I wrote, was published in 2006. And I was reading it earlier this year because I was making a selection of essays I'd written for a possible collection that I'm going to make of them. And I was particularly interested in this particular feature fascinated me. And it was also about this kind of painting, which is the kind of painting which happened in America in the 1950s and 60s, after the explosion of the success of abstract expressionism, and when this kind of work became even more more defined in its formalistic qualities. It became more hard-edged. There was less sense of any kind of figuration. And 20 years ago, I wrote this feature in which I tried to... I'd just seen an exhibition of Nolan's paintings in Liverpool, at Tate Liverpool. And I was fascinated by them. And I tried to, in the piece, to contextualize this work, which seemed at the time extremely remote, in the context of contemporary work of the time, work of the mid-2000s, when there was, in fact, a kind of small re-emergence of some of these tendencies in contemporary art and contemporary painting, when suddenly abstraction, having been a kind of a dirty word, formalist abstraction had been neglected, avoided, disliked for two decades, suddenly became visible again. There was suddenly, what I was fascinated by was how different it was from this work which was made in the 50s and 60s.
That's Kenneth Noland.
In the 50s and 60s. And not only him, but there were a few, Morris Lewis, there are others. And they were making this very quite dry, self-referential painting, which sometimes is called post-painterly abstraction, sometimes called color field painting. It happened in the aftermath of abstract expressionism. And I was thinking in that piece about the relation between contemporary forms of formalist abstraction and this earlier work, and finding them and trying to understand how different they were. And
can you name somebody from the mid-2000s that you might be thinking of? Can you remember?
I think I referred to Ugo Rondinone and Sege Jensen, people like that, who were making work which actually referred to this work from the 50s and 60s, but was entirely different from it in spirit. And I also related this work that was happening in America, in the United States, with work that happened slightly earlier, maybe in the 1970s and 80s in Europe, made by people like Gunter Ferg and Blinky Palermo, and also how different it was, all of which pointed to the fact that this work in America, made in America in the post-war and 60s, was, it had a quality which seemed completely alien to 50 years later.
Yes.
Even though there's art then in the mid-2000s and now which seems superficially to resemble it. The spirit of this work had been left behind, and I think the new piece is another attempt to another take from a mid to 2020 vantage on what this difference amounts to,
yeah.
and also another attempt to interpret or to understand this work from the mid 50s to the mid 70s, which for me is I find it very obscure and very difficult to understand. I find it very complex.
Okay,
and it's also extremely unfashionable now. It's work which seems light years away from most contemporary art. It, simply in the fact that it doesn't involve any kind of referential content. In relation to contemporary art, you think, well, this seems extremely solipsistic. It seems very self-referential. It seems even self-indulgent. My feature is an attempt to another attempt to try to understand it.
Because at the time, there were people like Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried, weren't there? Whose writing was very, and I think you say, you know, is very dominant in the thinking by some painters, and Greenberg talks about, you know, discipline to criticize the discipline itself, so work that was criticizing itself and very insular within, yeah, painting about painting is a simple phrase, I suppose.
It's a very interesting period also, because there seems to have been a very tight connection between criticism and art at that time, as if both were supporting each other.
Yeah.
And both, in a way, pushing each other. And also a feeling that there was a kind of hothouse in atmosphere in New York art, in the New York art scene at the time, where, which was kind of blinkered, it seems now, because it's hard to understand how little there was a sense of how little doubt there was about the kind of strategies that these people were, the critics and the artists, were propounding. How little sense that, well, actually, wasn't this a very extremely narrow interpretation of what art could be? And there were dissenting voices, as I say in the text. I begin with Leo Steinberg, who wrote a really amazing, fascinating essay in which he, in the early 1970s, where he criticized the critics for, in a way, encouraging this kind of this view of art as being somehow separate, of being isolated from any anything beyond, art being isolated from anything beyond itself.
So, when expressionism was dropped, as it were, was that caused by these writers like Greenberg and Fried?
No, I don't think so. I think that Greenberg and Fried were champions of abstract expressionism, and they thought abstract expressionism was the apogee, the apotheosis of the greatest expression of 20th century art, a kind of peak. And they wanted this. I think that their criticism in the 60s and 70s was an attempt to also frame this art in relation to European art of the first half of the 20th century as a natural peak. And from this created a certain environment in which it was understood that there was a narrative which could then be developed. And those painters that I'm writing about, which I'm not writing about the abstract expressionists so much as these painters that came the next generation, when there was already a sense that this culture of late modernist painting, a lot of it, this insular culture, had become was considered to be the be all and end all of modernist art, the defining point, and this created an enormous amount of confidence, I think, and also a sense of maybe even a sense of complacency, and that these artists felt that they were surrounded by a sense of confirmation when they were making work which now seems extremely vulnerable to appearing to have argue its case or to present it as if it was sealed by a culture of which conferred upon it a sense of its own authority.
Yes.
And I'm trying to reconsider what this insularity might mean, And I looked at it again over the this year, looking at these paintings again, and I started to see it in the context of, in a more contemporary context, and also in relation to, I started to, this is art which excised any sense of political context, of referential context, of cultural allusion. Well, there's obviously some sense of, there's also, it refers to other art, but only at a remove. It almost blinds itself to any sense of the past and future. It's an art which is focused on its own present. And I started to think, imagine if consider this extreme formalism from a different angle as being about shutting out what it couldn't accommodate, as being instead of being a form of certainty and autonomy, perhaps as being a form of self-protection.
Yeah, because you mentioned fear a number of times. You used the word fear a number of times. But also, you mentioned Leo Steinberg, and what, there's some kind of connection I think he makes, you say, towards sign and the graphics and this painting, this late abstract formalist, you know, the stripe, say, of Nolan and people appearing or paralleling, perhaps is the word, with things going on outside in America, but the sort of dominance really of the coming, you know, advertising and signs and capitalism's, you know, almost as if, and it made me think, oh, is this work actually being supported or being, you know, because it was actually exported, wasn't it, after the, to be seen around the world as a kind of, it is very American, and it connects to this thing going on in America.
Absolutely. And I write about, you're right, I write about that in the piece, that one of the things Steinberg in the essay with which I quote, he interprets the hard-edged geometric formalism of people, of artists like Noland and Stella, Frank Stella. He associates that with post-war capitalist culture. He says, look, these things can be compared to the design of American cars, the post-war boom in automobile manufacture, in the and to the kind of logos which were being designed to advertise and to represent these various companies who are producing these things. So as a kind, and he saw these paintings as connected to this to American capitalist manufacturing culture.
Yeah, you quote saying stripes have become symbolic of the latest in technology. Yeah. So the stripes in the paintings are replicated, or vice versa, maybe in logos representing the latest technology, which is presumably a capitalist, you know.
Right. Yeah, and I think that there's a lot to be. One can also see that these paintings became, once they were accommodated, assimilated by the art market, they were often collected and presented in these contexts, in boardrooms, corporate boardrooms, in lobbies of multinational corporations. So that, in a sense, confirms Steinberg's point. But I would, my reading of that is that I think it's a little bit tendentious. I feel that this painting, it simplifies the painting.
Yeah, I would agree.
It simplifies the painting to reduce it to synonymity with the logo design or with the design of an automobile. I think that actually these paintings, although maybe you could say that the artist didn't pay enough attention to the in their outlook, in their to the possibility of the way that they were designing their works being co-opted by this kind of viewpoint, this kind of design culture. I think that the work itself it resists that and is actually more about working negatively, about expelling association, and I think that it does that by in the way that it expels time, that it expels association, and it does that in technically very often, in informally, by, for example, by making the compositions, the designs, absolutely coincidental with the supports. So it's a kind of compression. And I think that one can see this, this negative capability, you could say, when you compare this work in the piece I wrote in the mid 2000s, I was comparing this work to later work, and in this feature now, I'm also comparing it to later work, but different later work. I compare it, for example, to painting in the 1980s. By Sherry Levine and Elaine Sturtevant, in which it's quite clear that those artists are referring to either specifically in Sturtevant, in the work of Sturtevant, where she actually replicates her stellar paintings from the early 1960s, or in Levine, where she creates a kind of generic form. She evokes a generic form of formalist stripe painting. But both of them do this in a way which makes it clear that they're being formally, that they are referring to something retrospectively
and outside of their work.
Outside of their work, which is the antithesis of what an artist like Kenneth Noland was doing. And so I think this is simply that comparison is very revealing in terms of the particular kind of autonomy, and which is also a kind of refusal to look, and that those artists like Noland and like Stella were cultivating back then.
Why did Sturtevant, so this is not an easy question probably, but why did Sturtevant copy Stella's work? What was the reason given for doing it?
Sturtevant, all of Sturtevant's work, all of her art involves replicating the work of other artists from the past. And also, this also applies to Sherry Levine's work. I mean, not all of it, but although they're both working retrospectively, the interesting thing with that, those particular works that she made in the late 1980s, where she copied, all her copies are very, they're formally very, uh, um, they're exact. Unlike Levine's copies, Levine's paintings very often look nothing like the when the I just saw an exhibition in Berlin of Sherry Levine's work in which she copies some Mondrian paintings. They don't look anything like Mondrian's paintings.
No, I looked at that online. They don't, do they? They're more graphic-y or
they're totally.
Well, Mondrian's paintings are very handmade, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
And also, I imagine hers are very tight. It's a bit like, I was thinking of Liam Gillick's work as well when I was reading this, because the precision and finish and manufacture, literally, of his work, say, is even better than Judd, and that's saying something. And then you go up this line of because there's a lot of hand touch in this early 50s, 60s painting you're referring to. You know, if you look at the work, you can see how it's made, can't you? Comparatively.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about those, the paintings of some of it, certainly in Frank Stella's painting, you have a lot of although they're geometric, there's a lot of manual evidence of the trace of his activity, of the fact that he made it, the fact that you see the edges, although they are stripes, they're not hard. Whereas with Nolan, they are quite hard. At least the work that I'm there is almost no evidence of
okay
manual of manual process, but. I think that to go back to Sturtevant, she tried to. I have the impression whenever I see. I mean, for example, she's copied. I think she tries to make the replica as exact as possible, but she does that in the understanding that that's impossible. And I think that I've not actually seen the Stella paintings.
Apparently, she does it from memory.
No. I mean,
although Warhol, she actually got the screens from Warhol.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the Warhol copies, which I saw in Berlin a couple of years ago, and they were striking. Although she made them at the same time with the same screens which Warhol lent to her. They don't look anything like Warhol's paintings or Warhol's flower paintings, although they were made with the same.
Extraordinary, really.
And I think that I've not seen the Stella paintings except in reproduction, the paintings she made, which she made 30 years later, 30 years after Stella made his paintings.
Right.
I've not seen them, but I'm told by a friend who has seen them that they also look, although they're the same. That the formats are almost exactly the same. The compositions are precisely mapped on to the supports in the same way that Stella mapped his paintings onto his supports. She even used the same paint, which she managed to source somehow. From 30 years, she found some shop in New York which had the same
enamel. Old tins at the back of a shelf.
Old tins, what do you call it? Like dead stock. So, although apparently she goes to all the attempts to make the specifications precisely correct. A friend of mine said they also look like Sturtevant paintings. They don't look. They look wrong as copies of Stella.
It's so. Which is odd, isn't it, really? Because you think, in a sense, that you'd be losing the idea of the self and the individual by repeating someone else's work. It's almost like you're trying not to make work of your own and to make a statement about loss of individuality or something. But in actual fact, by her failure to do it, because it's impossible, you actually draw attention to the fact more. That makes it. It's funny.
It's like if an artist tries to, when an artist is young and is influenced by another artist, an artist that they idolize from the past, they try to do it and they become themselves by failing to be like the artist that they would like to emulate,
who they aspire to. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. But the point I wanted to make about the Sturtevant is that I think that this work is essentially retrospective. So that the point is that if all the parameters, the formal parameters, are in place, there's 30 years between Sturtevant's copies and Frank Stella's originals, and the culture has moved on exponentially in those 30 years. And I think that that is what she's referring to. She's actually framing time as a formal parameter,
right?
And I think that's what makes you aware. It's very incisive, because it makes you aware that time is also a formal parameter for the artist that she's copying, but in a negative sense, in the sense that they were trying to excise time. They were trying to eradicate it. They were trying to produce a kind of work which was limited to the moment of the presence, the moment of perception, the moment of engagement between the viewer and without it being in any way distracted by reference, by illusion, by memory, and I think that a lot of this work, this limitation to the present, I'm seeing as you say, a form of fear, a form of blocking out what American culture of this time doesn't want to look at, doesn't want to acknowledge to itself, I guess.
Yes. Yes. So you, in other words, it might be doing things abroad, like the Vietnam War, or it might have huge poverty or something like that, but it somehow or other is in denial. Is this a form of denial?
Yeah, I do try to sketch a kind of context, but I think that the danger with that is that it makes this work seem like a metaphor for this, like a kind of anti-metaphor, you could say. But I don't think it is. I think it's simply a refusal to look, a kind of reluctance. And I think that when a lot this feature came it on the one hand it came out of rereading this piece I wrote in 2006, but it also came out of something a friend of mine, an American friend, said to me, who lives in Chicago, over the summer, and we were talking, we've been talking endlessly about the American political situation in the run-up to the election, to the US election. And he said something about that it's a split screen, it's become, the United States has become a split screen culture. That's his phrase.
Like we are now on Zoom.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. We're a divided culture, which is not willing. Well, I mean, the thing is, I can see you and I'm looking at you, we're communicating. But his point is that America, the United States, has become two worlds which are, in a way, cannot acknowledge one another, even that don't accept one another's premises, one another's intentions, one another's beliefs, actually are afraid of the other. Each is afraid of the other. So he used this phrase, split screen culture, divided between, the red side and the blue side of the political divide. And this that also made me think. And I suddenly thought, imagine... Isn't it striking how much American art and mass culture, I mean, from the past, since the 1950s, reflects that kind of spirit of of there being other parts of the country, other people, other cultures within the country. I mean, the United States is vast, which are to be feared. I mean, I thought about it. It started me thinking about cinema and about how, because the interesting thing about that about Kenneth Noland and Frank Stella and Morris Lewis is this is a kind of art which didn't want to have, unlike pop art, for example, which was being in its heyday around the same time in the mid 60s. This painting wanted to have nothing to do with mass culture. It saw mass culture as being not even to be compared with what the high culture which these artists were engaged in, and Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried were promulgating. It was like they wouldn't have even acknowledged it, I don't think. But I, looking at it's fascinated me how, when I look back and if seeing this painting from us in a certain spirit, it struck me how much I could relate it to the tradition of American cinema, which emerged around the same time, had its golden age around the same time in the 1970s, with films like Deliverance, French Connection, where you had which were all films about the somewhere else, about either being invaded by somewhere by some other entity which is threatening and violent, or straying into another part of the United States, which exists on a different plane, and which is incomprehensible and turns out to be extremely threatening.
You like Blue Velvet being within America, but actually there's a hidden.
Yeah,
something like the ear in the grass at the beginning.
Exactly,
something going on, but you're not really aware of it.
It's a kind of narrative that runs through a lot of the most interesting American, even a lot of trashy stuff like The Purge or you know, horror films like Blair Witch.
So they're dealing with these films are sort of saying there is another which you can be scared of, either here or out there, but they are acknowledging what it might be.
Yeah.
That's the difference, is it?
Yeah.
That you're saying between the paintings and them, but they're running parallel almost as art forms. You see, that's where Warhol's quite interesting to me, because he's not afraid to acknowledge, say, the commodity or the capitalist system. When he, you know, he's surely by having Brillo pad boxes and, you know, things. How does he fit in with your?
Yeah, I mean, this is it's interesting that at the time when these guys in New York were making their stripe paintings and their stain paintings, and seeing them as the kind of the cutting edge of modernist the modernist tradition. At the same time, Andy Warhol was making his most, probably the most, his most important silkscreen paintings, in his early silkscreen paintings, and actually, although it would seem in retrospect that there was a kind of mutual disregard and incomprehension between those two camps, between Lichtenstein and Warhol and the formalists, they were working at the same time, and they were also, there's also a kind of osmosis or a kind of leakage. I mean, in the sense that Warhol very clearly alludes to formalist abstract painting. Often he obviously alludes to gestural abstraction, abstract expressionist painting, in the sense that he applies these gestural strokes, which he then prints an image onto. He also, in some of his early works from the early 60s, refers to geometric abstract painting in terms of the way that he divides the zones of color, which he then prints onto, in terms of the paintings he made of Liz Taylor, where you have like two Lizzes, one on top of the other. It also looks like a late Rothko in terms of the formally speaking, which is a late Rothko's geometric formalism. I think that there's seepage between those two, but they're coming from completely different assumptions, and I think that Warhol was in a way satirizing as much as paying tribute to that. That there was a kind of mutual hatred or mutual. But I think that if Warhol was making, working ironically sometimes, taking this work, presenting this work ironically, on the other side, there was a kind of, I think there was a kind of blindness, and that was part, the blindness was a symptom of the whole nature of the work that they were engaged with, which was about shutting out what mass culture, shutting out any kind of reference beyond the forms of the work, and the forms being a kind of shield. So I think that although there is I don't think there's much pop art in Kenneth Noland or in Morris Lewis, but I think there is, it goes the other way. But if you look at it in with hindsight, it's fascinating how that they were happening at the same time. And that makes you aware of how much this work that the formalists were producing was a kind of voluntary
answer?
Blindness, yeah, a kind of a self-protective mechanism, you could say.
Listen, just because I mentioned in the beginning, Cameron Rowland's show that you describe, I'm really interested to know how that work that you mentioned there fits in with this development. So we've got, say you get to Sturt event and then we sort of move into Cameron Rowland. I mean, Cameron Rowland is somebody whose work I didn't really know, but I read that he, for instance, one of his pieces of work was, I think it was in Glasgow International a few years back, and it was to lock some cemetery gates. And that was the work. So he seems to come from a completely other place in terms of what we're talking about.
Well, maybe. I mean, the work I was writing, I was writing about a show I saw in Frankfurt about a couple of years ago, which in, I mean, you ask me how does this relate to the work I'm writing about, the American formalist tradition, and I think that I'm also asking that too.
Sure,
I'm asking myself, well, what could work like this, which is American art, American contemporary art, North American, U.S. contemporary art, have to do with a Nolan Stripe painting?
That's a great question. Maybe just say what the work is. Because you do, I think you describe it, but even that's...
This exhibition consisted of various objects in what looked like a kind of corporate office space, except it was an institutional space. A kind of gallery, but like an office floor, and in it there were a combination of objects which were either historical objects, objects which had some kind of relation to the slave trade in the United States, in the southern United States, but often via a European connection.
So they were made in Europe, say.
For example, there was an object, I think a loom, a cotton loom, which had been made in Osnabrück, which is a city in Germany, in the 18th century, and had been shipped to the United States to function on a plant and there was some other objects like this. There was a sugar kettle, which was also of this period.
That they would have been used by slaves on plantations or something like that.
They were of this period, and they were from this context.
Right.
And there were other objects which had only a kind of associative connection. They weren't actually physical traces of anything. They weren't historical objects. They were only maybe like a piece of old rope which was strung across the space, and
a billhook, you say?
A billhook, which this is something historical. It's a long sort of pole or a shaft.
So they have kind of like use. They've been used.
Yeah,
the hand on kind of thing.
Yeah, and they were. But the relation to that, they suggest a past which they actually don't. They don't confirm in terms of a trace. In any, they don't confirm the relate. So they evoke what they don't specify.
So they bring up imaginary possibilities.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, they suggest a history which they can only connote. You could say. They can only evoke, even though they do have some of them more than others. Some of them could be traces which actually place them on the scene of these horrors that happened in the U.S. During the slave era, right? So, but. You asked me, what do they have to do with the US formalist tradition, which is now a kind of dead tradition, as I say. It's a tradition which has, it's an extinct tradition. And I say, well, actually, I think that for me, the connection is to do with this sense of the being an ulterior world, which they don't refer to, which they can't, but in fact, they do the opposite. They block reference. They suggest how the object itself can't refer to what it nonetheless evokes or connotes. So again, there's a kind of self-protective mechanism.
Because obviously an object can't self-protect, but do you mean in a sense that, so the artist chooses these things, presents them, but through their lack of bringing them alive, as it were, to tell a narrative, given to be a narrative that is understandable, he is being protective in some way?
I think that the work, if you think of art as being... If you think of any form of like a language, image, object, these are forms which can refer. They can represent, they can describe, they can be about something else, right?
Like a metaphor, even.
No, like just in terms of representation, if you have a picture, it's not, you have a picture of a tree, you're not seeing a tree, you're seeing an object which refers to a tree.
Yes,
right?
But you think tree.
You think tree when you see it because you see its image. The point is that that these are objects. I think that this one of the things which divides the work of a contemporary artist like Cameron Rowland and an artist from the 1950s and 60s such as Kenneth Noland is minimalism, which is a kind of art which also blocked reference. And this is the, you can see when you look at Cameron Rowland's pieces, although they are not this isn't minimalist art, it's a kind of post-minimalism in the sense that he's using found objects, placing them as forms of sculpture, which, like a minimalist cube or a Robert Morris cube or a Donald Judd stacked piece, they reject the possibility of reference. They're kind of, in a way, they're sealed. They refuse representation. And I think that although his works have one, that they use the same devices, the same strategies as the minimalists, but they do it through found objects. So you can see the sugar kettle is like a big dome shape object. You can look at it and you can see it. It could be at a glance be mistaken for a form of minimalist sculpture, but it's not. It is actually a trace. It's a trace. It's a historical trace of usage of a culture in which it had a certain significance. The fact that it does both of those things, the fact that it's both self-protecting, the fact that it's both refusing to acknowledge its past in terms of its relation to minimalism and in terms of its function as an art object in a gallery, and at the same time is also, to some extent, more or less, one doesn't really know, a historical trace, dramatizes this aspect of the extent to which one can know something, a past, which in this case is extremely threatening and unbearable. This relates, can be, I think that in that way it can be connected to that tradition. I mean, the other thing about Rowland is the way that he markets his work, or the way that he often has a kind of self-protective relation to the market, in the sense that he refuses to sell a lot of his works. He rents them.
Amazing.
He rents them, in which he retains the initiative, you could say. But this relation to the market has a similar spirit. It's also self-protective, I think. It's also, it treats the market as similarly predatory, you could say, as the histories that he is ambiguously connoting.
But he sees it as connected to the histories that are horrible? The market, do you think?
I think that it's a question of what. No, I don't think he does. I think it's about an ambiguity. It's about the connection's never there. It's about the possibility of a connection, which he refuses to make literal.
Okay.
And I think that in that refusal, his strategy from the point of view of my text can be compared to the refusal of an artist like Nolan to deal with what Steinberg calls human experience. It's a kind of shield.
Very well put. I'm really grateful. I think you've done a great job of opening up this piece for people who I really hope will read it, because there's a lot more in it than we've covered. The one little tiny thing is ringing, because you've got a tiny bit of time. We've got about 4 minutes. At one point, you mentioned something like how postmodern art, so perhaps post-formalist abstract painting might be the right phrase for it, actually is, you said it's something like more commodifiable or more likely to end up in the boardroom than the original formalist work. Somehow now, because it's free, you say something like it's freed, or it doesn't have its kind of, the original paintings had a kind of, you know, I can't think of the right word, but you know, they have their own philosophy, or the you know, whereas the postmodern stuff didn't have anything, it just became product. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the what you can say, and I think this is mysterious in retrospect to me now looking back, is that this work of the 1950s and 60s had a kind of unassailable air of certainty about the meaningfulness. Not meaning's the wrong word, because meaning implies a certain kind of content, about the authority of its forms, and it needed nothing to justify this, that somehow these forms had an inherent significance in relation to a modernist tradition, which they were the cutting edge of, presented themselves as the cutting edge of. The artists presented themselves as operating at the cutting edge of this tradition. And I think that if you look back, this certainty, this assurance is gone. It's startling. It's extraordinary how implausible this now seems. Like the idea of somebody making a painting like Kenneth Nolan now and presenting it as having any kind of authority is rising, right? But the point I'm making is that people who are working in this idiom now are having to supplement what they're doing with all kinds of narratives and contextual material, and in order to fill in the gaps which Nolan had no problems with. And my point is that this work, the equivalent, if there is an equivalent, to is much, because it doesn't have this assurance of its own spirit, of its own significance, is much more likely to appear as simply decor. So, yeah.
Listen, we could go on. You're great. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I thank you so much, Mark Prince, for coming on the Art Monthly talk show.
My pleasure.
You know, I can watch him with stopwatch tick away. We're literally going down 15 seconds now to the end of the program. So thank you so much for coming on, Mark. This is a piece in the December-January issue of Art Monthly, number 482. Please do get a copy, subscribe to the magazine and read it.